The next case on the court's calendar this morning is Oberpriller versus Walton. We're ready for oral arguments. Counsel for appellant may approach the podium and begin. Please introduce yourself for the record before you begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Christopher.
I'm sorry. The podium does raise if you would prefer.
That would be wonderful.
A height that's more consistent with yours.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Haugen from Meserle and Kramer on behalf of the appellant. The party's subsequent conduct here, it matters. Respondent Nick Walton would like this court to be laser focused on the binding term sheet's terms, rather than avoid discussing the months the parties spent trying to reach a full and final settlement agreement on all the material and essential terms.
But isn't that putting the cart before the horse a little bit? I mean, shouldn't we start with the agreement to see whether or not it is indeed a settlement agreement, and if it has all the necessary terms, and if it doesn't, to look at other evidence as to what happened between the parties? Don't we start with the agreement?
You would start with the agreement, but
okay,
here are the
then let's start with the agreement then.
Okay, well, here the binding term sheet clearly states that a settlement agreement will be forthcoming. They set a 5-day deadline, which obviously was missed because in those 5 days, both parties realized that there were material and essential terms that were not found in the binding term sheet, and they immediately began working on coming up with a schedule and respondent refers to as a long-form settlement agreement that would address those issues. So they immediately begin working, I think it's 5 days after, they immediately begin working on a schedule to address numerous issues that the parties realized were not covered in the binding term sheet.
Mr. Haugen, is it critical that the binding term sheet agreement itself does not include any language that makes that agreement contingent on the subsequent negotiating that apparently there's no dispute the parties were doing, and it is referenced? If you understand my question.
Yeah, I think I do. So there's no language in the binding term sheet that says that there's a condition precedent that none of this becomes enforceable until there's a final settlement agreement. Is that
correct?
Yeah. No, I don't think so, because at least the binding term sheet contemplates that the parties are going to be working on a long-form settlement agreement. And what happened, I think it's really important to know what actually happened between these parties. And the parties began looking at that binding term sheet and said, man, there's a lot missing here. They were working off a document that had 150 items, and the binding term sheet addressed less than half of those. So the attorneys started moving back and forth, trying to agree on terms in this schedule to trying to agree on a long-form settlement agreement. By September, the parties were still struggling to reach agreement on those terms. But the evidence that's in the record related to Schedule 2 put forward by Daniel Oberpriller, which is unrefuted, is that though Schedule 2 contains material and essential terms to that settlement agreement, terms that were important, and they're still negotiating them 3-4 months down the road. Walton himself is sending drafts of the long-form settlement agreement.
Oh, you're getting forward. You're forward-looking again. I want to look at the agreement itself, because it's very common for parties and companies to enter into a term sheet. And the key is whether or not the essential terms to that agreement are in that term sheet. Oftentimes, you'll have a term sheet, and it'll have a broad picture. Here are the items, and we all agree that we're going to do this. We're all going to agree we're going to move forward on this business venture. We all agree we're going to settle this case. We all agree on whatever they want to agree to. The key question is whether or not there's enough information in that term sheet to actually bind the parties. If not, then that really, I think, ends the inquiry right there. If there is enough there, then the parties are bound, regardless of what the subsequent details are worked out. So I guess my question to you is a broad question of what is missing in this binding term sheet that does not make it, that doesn't bind the parties to its terms? I mean, we already talked about the fact that there's nothing, it's not conditioned on something else occurring later. Right. And it says the parties agree to settle this case. And the parties signed it. They had their counsel there. It talks about some of the specific things that need to be done in terms of winding up the business between the parties. So what are What is or what are the material terms in this agreement that are missing?
In Daniel Oberpriller's declaration submitted in opposition to the motion to enforce the settlement agreement, he identifies them.
Okay.
He says specifically that the parties had not decided how to distribute profits from the sales of the entities. They had not decided who would be the new managers and officers of the various entities.
How is that important in terms of who the new officers are? How is that a term that is necessary to settle this lawsuit?
So as the parties were going through a business divorce, they were trying to unwind their varying entities. And as part of doing that, for example, let's use, they had these large development contracts with different developers. And these development proceeds were some very significant, I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And there was a dispute about four of the key entities. None of that was one of the key disputes in the case, and that doesn't appear in the binding term sheet, how to resolve that. It appears in Schedule 2. It was a term that the parties needed to get in Schedule 2 in order to make sure that they had actually wound up their affairs and they had actually reached agreement on all the issues they needed to reach agreement to in order to actually have a settlement that would work for both parties.
Right, but that goes to implementation of the terms in the binding term sheet.
Yes and no. There are some, I understand. There are some terms in Schedule 2 that do, in fact, discuss implementing the terms of the binding term sheet. But in those days immediately following the parties' agreement to the terms in the binding term sheet, everybody realized there were issues not present, not just execution, not just, you know, and we're not talking about a settlement agreement where we just need to talk about a small provision. There were large issues that were left undecided. And that's what the parties, I mean, if it were as simple as a small term that the parties couldn't agree on, Mr. Walton could have brought this motion immediately. But
Mr.
they were
Haugen,
large terms.
I wonder if, and I'm struggling with the same questions, and is that not a separate issue? So the district court here is presented with a motion to enforce this agreement. Would not the court first, number one, limit itself to the four corners of this agreement, conclude whether it's ambiguous, and if it's not, that would end that, whereas the issue related to some of the provisions, it does appear the parties presumed many details of a very complicated business arrangement had not been worked out, so they contemplated that. But is that not a separate issue? Is there may still be some litigation if the parties can't implement what's in this document because they have two different ideas of how to do that and they didn't reach an agreement. Or conversely, the last language after the last, right before the signatures, arguably a party could claim someone's not negotiating in good faith on those phrases. But is not the question whether the court erred in simply looking at this document, determining whether it's ambiguous or not, to then decide whether to look at anything outside of its four corners?
I think there are two parts there. The first part, and the way that it results in the district court needing to look at what actually happened rather than just the four corners, is that the binding term sheet itself says it's not the settlement agreement. It says it's not. It says that the parties are going to continue working towards a long-form settlement agreement, which is perfectly consistent with what Walton and Oberpriller both did. Oberpriller's counsel circulated an agreement on September 12th called the long-form settlement agreement, attaching Schedule 2 with all the new terms. And I think that's a key difference here in this case versus many of the other cases cited is a lot of times, Your Honor's right, it's the parties agree on all the terms, but one party says there was a term that was left out. And then there's a fight about whether that should have been included or not, or whether it was material or essential. But here, both parties worked together on a new schedule that was going to be part of the long-form settlement agreement. So there, in so many of the cases cited by respondent, it was the parties already agreed there was a settlement. It was a motion to vacate the settlement. There was a motion to enforce a specific provision, but both parties agreed there was a settlement agreement. Here what we're dealing with is whether a settlement agreement ever actually materialized.
Well, I think the issue isn't so much whether this was a settlement agreement. I don't, and I'm sure your opposing counsel may take issue with my comment, but I don't see this as a settlement agreement per se. It references a settlement agreement to be subsequently entered into. But I think the question is whether this bound the parties to settle this lawsuit. And so I want to come back again to this contract. One of the arguments that you make is that BTS is ambiguous. how is it ambiguous? And keep in mind that ambiguity in defining a contract means there are two or more reasonable interpretations of that contract. What are the two or more interpretations of this contract that make it ambiguous?
Well, in the terms in referencing, you know, ambiguity in the contract, what we were really saying is that the binding term sheet itself can't be the settlement agreement because there is a provision in there that indicates there's going to be another agreement coming down the road. So that was the ambiguity I was pointing out, not that a specific sentence of it was particularly ambiguous. We think it says what it says. But I think that it's important also to address, you know, the standard of review that this court should be using here, because I think that was a bit murky and that there is case law sort of suggesting it can be two different things. At least the parties are on the same page that it's a hybrid standard of review here, that some portion of this case is governed by an abuse of discretion and some portion is de novo. But the core thrust of this court's review here, whether a settlement agreement was ever actually created, came into existence, we're applying core contract principles of offer acceptance in terms of consideration and in terms of a settlement agreement, whether it contains all the material and essential terms. And many times this court has stated language just as follows, you know, an appeal from a dismissal of an action pursuant to a settlement agreement, this court must decide whether there are any material issues of fact and whether the district court erred as a matter of law. And the standard of review for that is de novo. So I wanted to, you know, make sure that at least we're viewing it through the correct lens. The district court's
right, that's part of the standard of review, but we also review what the district court did for an abuse of discretion. So you can have nested standards of review that we have. You keep referring to conduct that occurred afterward. Didn't defendant or respondent write a check in to show that that there was actual understanding between the parties of what this agreement meant, and now it's time for us to execute this?
What about that check that was written? Yes, the parties did immediately begin executing on various terms of the binding term sheet. Previously, the parties had entered into two other agreements, limited settlement agreements, and they immediately began executing on those. So it's true that they started to immediately execute on the provisions therein. They didn't fulfill the expectations therein, but there's a difference between having an agreement the parties realize they're going to have to follow and having a full and final settlement agreement with all the material and essential terms that results in dismissal of the case. If one of the parties thought if that check had not been written, Mr. Oberpriller probably would have had a right to amend the complaint and ask add a claim for a breach of contract related to the binding term sheet. But there's a difference in the question about whether that agreement contained all of the material and essential terms that the parties needed, which would result in a dismissal of the case as opposed to a breach of the contract. And that's really the thrust of our argument here, is that when the parties jointly, not just one party going off and doing it on his own and saying, oh, we missed all these terms, when the parties jointly create a brand new schedule containing never before negotiated terms that contain material and essential terms to the agreement, it doesn't make sense to go back and say, well, actually, disregard this new schedule and all of these new terms because we had a meeting of the minds on all of the old provisions and that was everything that was necessary in order for there to be a settlement agreement. If there was truly a meeting of the minds on the binding term sheet containing all of the material and essential terms of the settlement agreement, the parties wouldn't have been negotiating these new schedules.
Well, wouldn't they be negotiating a schedule? Couldn't you have a scenario where let's assume, I realize you're arguing differently, let's assume all the material and essential terms are in the binding term sheet, and it says we're going to use this as a basis to put together a settlement agreement. Mm-hmm. Let's assume for the sake of argument that BTS does contain all the material and essential terms. The fact that they're going to put together a more robust settlement agreement, that doesn't necessarily change the fact that they can be bound by the BTS, right?
I agree. Okay. I agree. That's actually the most of the cases cited, I would say, in the briefing. There's not a case really like this one. I didn't find one, I don't think. Opposing counsel cited one. Most of the cases involve those sort of fact patterns where the parties agree they're going to come to a long-form settlement agreement, But they've agreed, and some of the cases they agreed on the record in front of the judge, that this is all the material and essential terms. The difference here, and we think it's a fundamental one, is that the parties work together, not just on this, we need to put in, there's a discussion of a non-disparagement clause. Yeah, that was important, and that was a sticking point for the parties. But Schedule 2 was a whole new list of terms and conditions that are not present in the BTS, which the parties really needed to decide upon. In short, there are just too many genuine issues of material fact here about whether the parties intended the binding term sheet to be their full and final settlement agreement and whether it contained all of the provisions. Their actions demonstrate that. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Andy Pieper of the Sewell Reeves firm, along with my colleague Emily Atmore, appearing on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you.
And may it please the court. In this case, the district court correctly held that the parties entered a valid and enforceable settlement when they executed the binding term sheet. In doing so, the district court properly interpreted the parties' agreement to immediately dismiss the underlying lawsuit and release each other from their claims. On this appeal, Mr. Oberpriller wants to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted to immediately enjoy the benefits of the BTS, a contract he concedes in his reply brief is valid and enforceable, but did not want to comply with his obligations, including his obligation to immediately dismiss the claims in the district court litigation. That is not how Minnesota law treats settlements or contracts of any nature, as the district court correctly ruled, and this court should affirm. There are two primary questions for consideration here, one of which was resolved by Mr. Oberpriller's concessions in the reply brief, and Judge Reyes, I believe you hit on it. The first question is whether, in fact, the parties reached an agreement. Oberpriller concedes that the BTS is a valid enforceable contract at pages 3 to 4 and 11 of his reply brief. So there's no dispute that the parties formed a contract when they entered the BTS. So no further consideration of that issue is necessary, and you need not even address the standard of review debate on that question. The second point here is then whether the district court correctly interpreted the BTS as a matter of contract law. Here, the district court did properly interpret the BTS as immediately binding by the plain language of the contract itself, effective as of the date it was signed in June 2018, and that the parties unambiguously agreed to mutual releases and dismissal of their claims. So let's consider the district court's interpretation of the BTS. First, the district court correctly found and held that the BTS expressly provided that the terms were binding on the parties and effective as of the date it was signed. That is evident in the BTS in the very first word of the document, which says binding. It doesn't say a term sheet. It doesn't say a memorandum of understanding. It says it's a binding term sheet. The preamble goes on to say that the agreement set forth therein were binding and effective as of June 21st, 2018, which is the date that the parties executed the documents at the conclusion of their settlement meeting. The district court also found, and the BTS expressed unambiguously, that the parties would mutually release each other of their claims except for the obligations set forth therein. I would point the court to paragraphs H and I of the BTS, which is at respondent's addendum, page 16. And I think that except for the obligations set forth herein language in those mutual releases is actually really important and gets on to the questions that were raised during appellant's arguments, which is that the releases that are applying are the releases as to the disputed issues in the underlying litigation. That expressly leaves recourse for, in this case, the appellant or the respondent to have a remedy under this as a contract, whether in a breach of contract, separate breach of contract action because somebody is not performing as they're obligated to. The third point is that the BTS and the district court found that it expressly provided for the immediate dismissal of the lawsuit. That is in paragraph J at a respondent's addendum, page 16. Those terms, those release terms, those dismissal terms were not made contingent. They weren't conditioned on some future agreement. They were made immediately effective by virtue of this agreement. And then, as your honors can see throughout the BTS, it's a six-page single-space document that goes through numerous exchanges of promises, including exchanges of payments that would be made from, for example, Mr. Walton to Mr. Oberpriller. So
Mr.
as the
Pinker,
district court found the party's intention to settle and dismiss the lawsuit.
Excuse me, Mr. Pinker.
Counsel,
I just interrupt you a moment.
Yeah.
Could you address the point that was raised, but in the main point, I think, of appellant, the fundamental, I think the phrase he used, difference, that this is not a settlement agreement that's consistent with all the case law that's been cited, that referencing complete and even uses that phrase, a complete and final. It seems clear here, not just by the title of the document, by the language itself, that there's many and maybe many more. And in fact, the number of pages, even just in Schedule 2 alone, which apparently is just a start, if I understand correctly, of all the details. Do you disagree with that phrase or its effect, perhaps, on the motion that's made and the appellant's issue, that the fact that there seems to be general consensus, it's not in the real use of the word a complete final settlement, all the issues related to divorcing the business relationship of these parties?
And I don't think that there's any magic language, frankly, Your Honor, and that's consistent with the case law that says this is a settlement agreement and this is a full and final settlement agreement. I think that's that is the appellant making a distinction without a difference.
Well, but didn't the BTS itself reference the fact that the parties would be entering into a settlement agreement?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's also consistent with situations in which these types of motions to enforce settlements have arisen in other contexts.
Right,
so
but
I think
this
that
is, yeah, but this is a term sheet. A term sheet is very different than a final agreement. You have term sheets all the time. Those are preliminary. Those reflect the preliminary discussions that the parties have, and that's, you know, the vast majority of the time, that's followed up by some type of agreement that has all of the terms in it. And in this case, we're talking about a settlement agreement that would follow from there, and I think the parties recognize that in the BTS itself.
Yeah, I think that's the distinction here, Your Honor, is that it's expressly stated that this is binding, whereas other term sheets in commercial contexts would have caveats that would be conditioned, where the terms in the term sheet would be conditioned upon the resolution and the execution of some final agreement. Here, these terms were immediately executory by the nature of the language in the agreement itself. And then there is, as appellant's counsel pointed out, there is the paragraph at the end of the agreement that starts within 5 days of the effective date. Now, you have to be very careful with the language here, because it does not say, that language does not say the point to which the appellant contends, which is that the parties within 5 days will finalize an agreement. It merely says that within 5 days of the effective date, the parties will negotiate in good faith the terms and conditions of a settlement agreement. That happened. They did continue negotiating. There might be a question of whether that was good faith or not, that one side could lodge against the other. But the recourse there is, as I stated earlier, the recourse then is a separate breach of contract action or some other action to compel performance under the terms of this agreement as a valid and enforceable contract, as the appellant concedes.
Would that not mean effectively in a somewhat circular fashion that the contemplated settlement of the lawsuit really isn't settled because there's so many details of implementation that, in fact, wouldn't that parties be right back where they're at in terms of a lawsuit to force the separation of their business?
No, Your Honor, because that's where I pointed to the release language as and the except for the obligations set forth herein. So by that language, under this contract, the BTS, the parties wiped clean the slate for everything that came before the BTS. So then the question becomes, what recourse is there that the parties have if there is a failure of performance on any one of these 43 plus A through J enumerated terms in this six-page contract? The other thing that I would point to, Your Honor, is that that this language in the within 5 days of the effective date clause is not dissimilar. And in fact, it's actually analogous to a lot of the other cases where settlements are agreed, they're either mediated by a third party or they're put on the record before a court. For example, there's the Zahn Law Firm case, which is cited in our brief at page 10. And in that case, there was a very, the parties were on the eve of trial, and they had reached a settlement between the two of them. The trial judge said, okay, well, let's put the terms on the record. They put a very short statement on the record as far as, well, these are the terms in which we agree. There was a caveat put in there that where the appellant's counsel said, well, you know, we're obviously going to have to work out some issues as far as how this claim is going to be handled in the bankruptcy case. This court found that settlement that was put on the record still contained the essential terms, even though there was this caveat that, well, we were going to have to agree on some other issues down the road, even though that they're you know, they may be critical to implementing this settlement. And some of the key language in that Zahn Law Firm case is that there were terms that were left expressly unresolved. And that's exactly what this within 5 days clause does. It leaves terms expressly unresolved. And therefore, because they're expressly unresolved in the BTS, they are not essential terms to the BTS as a contract. And that's really the important point in Zahn Law Firm. Appellant's counsel, Mr. Oberprill, also leaned heavily on the Schedule 2 document. I think we've already discussed that. However, I just want to note, Your Honor, that while settlements are contractual in nature, Minnesota law also recognizes that they need not be all-encompassing. There is a significant line of case law that says that settlements need not dot every I and cross every T in order to be enforceable. Ancillary issues, implementation issues, procedural issues, even unrelated issues can be reserved for later negotiation, and that will not negate the settlement. I would point Your Honors to the Ryan v. Ryan case, the Triple B&G case, the Unitarian Universalist Church v. City of Wayzata case. Those are all cited respondents' briefs, page 14 to 15. The other line of cases and legal issue that I would encourage Your Honors to consider is that, and Judge Reyes, you touched on this as well, as the parties negotiated other terms in Schedule 2 after they had executed and began performance under the BTS, that has no bearing on the interpretation and enforceability of the BTS itself. And there is another line of Minnesota case law that says a settlement should be enforced where the parties assent and proceed to perform, even if it includes reference to a future contract with additional terms that remain to be negotiated. And I would point Your Honors to respondents' brief at pages 15 and 21, as well as the Asbesto Products v. Healy Mechanical case and the TNT Properties v. TriStar Developers case. Here, as we've already discussed, the parties agreed to be immediately bound by the BTS, and there is no dispute, and appellant's counsel acknowledged, that performance began immediately. Mr. Walton paid over a check of more than $127,000 on the same day that the BTS was executed, expressly and on the face of the check itself, in satisfaction of terms in the BTS. Mr. Oberpriller did not put that check into escrow. He didn't hold on to it until execution of some later agreement. He cashed it. He accepted the payment. He accepted the benefit of the payment. He's never retendered the money. And that's also consistent with the record before the district court, in which Ms. Stevenson's affidavit lays out numerous terms. In fact, the vast majority of the terms that were either completed by October 2018, when this motion was coming up before the district court, or where substantial efforts were being made to complete performance, that is also not disputed. And performance under the BTS as a valid and enforceable agreement even occurred after dismissal of the district court litigation. It has continued to this day, including Mr. Oberpriller's acceptance of a $7,000 bottle of Louis XIII cognac as provided for under the kitchen sink items term.
Very important item, I'm sure.
I see that my time is running, Your Honors. We ask that the court reject Mr. Oberpriller's arguments on this appeal and affirm the district court's order enforcing the settlement. And unless there are no further questions, I will yield my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I just have two short points on rebuttal. The first related to the Zahn case. The key difference there is that the parties agreed on the record that their agreement contained all the essential and material terms. Then one party suggested there was a missing term and the court found it not to be essential or material. In this case, Oberpriller is the only person to provide any record evidence related to whether the terms in Schedule 2 were material and essential to the party's settlement agreement. He stated that they were. There's no contrary affidavit or declaration from Mr. Walton saying that they weren't. So that's the record evidence, is that the parties continued to negotiate and arrived at additional terms that were material and essential to the party's agreement. The other thing I wanted to touch on is that Walton, said that the parties did continue negotiating towards a settlement agreement. Well, that's true. That's very true. But then Walton should not be the party that's able to then erase the subsequent negotiations and the agreements that the parties came to related to Schedule 2 that were supposed to be incorporated into a long-form settlement agreement when the parties had a meeting of a minds on those terms and then revert back to a prior partial agreement and call that the settlement agreement. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments and briefing. The matter is submitted. You'll have a decision within the 90 days required by statute.